The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and on this week's podcast, we've got the skinny on the scandal that's erupted again around Google's controversial Maps service. The company claimed they knew nothing about the additional information that they collected when they were mapping the globe, including passwords and usernames, but a U.S. report says that they, in fact, did. We're also looking at the latest in telecommunications trends, from Apple's business strategy to the latest indication that Samsung has become the dominant player in the handset market. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. So in the news this week, web Goliath Google may have just hit a snafu. The company that famously promises to do no evil was accused of doing just that when it was discovered in 2010 that it had collected personal information about web users when gathering intel for its Maps service. Well, a report from a US regulator released this week has uncovered that Google did know about this feature in its collection strategy, despite their fervent denials at the time. Joining us to talk through this is Josh Halliday, The Guardian's media and technology reporter, and quite possibly in the studio, we have the team that is the hardest working at The Guardian. Thank you very much for taking the time, Josh. What is the story here? What's going on?
This report by the US Federal Communications Commission and published by Google on Sunday said that this engineer had explicitly developed this technology so that it could collect this payload information, which could include emails, passwords, text messages, and browsing history of millions of web users. We didn't know that before. The report also reveals that this engineer told two colleagues, including a senior manager, that the technology could capture this information, which was also not known before. Now, Google in May 2010 publicly admitted for the first time that it had captured some of this information. And then in October that year, after another investigation by a separate regulator, was forced to reveal more of what it knew about the data capture at the time.
So what the developer said is that it could capture this data. You know, it didn't necessarily. So did something have to be switched on? Was this actually explicitly exploited, this idea? Is this what the report is suggesting?
The Federal Communications Commission says that the technology was developed explicitly to capture this information. So it wasn't an on or an off switch. And what we know is that this engineer explored different ways that Google might be able to use this information once it had captured it, and on one occasion actually looked at the payload information himself to decide, him or herself, because we don't know the identity of the engineer, to see whether this was useful information. That is pretty serious, because before we had all assumed, and Google had been suggesting, that this information might have been captured, but once it became aware that it was potentially private, was sealed off in this, in this secure room in Mountain View, where no one but police, regulators, and even Google top brass could potentially have access to it. So it's potentially far more serious than we ever realised.
So Charles, this is a pretty massive accusation.
It's pretty classic, in as much as it's the constant problem that companies have when something goes wrong, which is that it's so often not the actual act itself that's wrong. It's the cover-up. It's what follows afterwards. And what's happened here is that Google was collecting this data. The code was first written October 2006 and seems to have gone through some modifications through to 2007. Started using it in 2007. In 2008, Engineer Doe, as the FCC calls it in the report, because he took the Fifth Amendment, that is in the US, he declined to testify on the grounds that could incriminate himself, because the FCC can determine if you've in effect done wiretapping, which is what this is investigations about. So he analysed the data in 2008. So they had a long time, given that they didn't admit it until May 2010, in which they could be looking at this in all sorts of ways. And the FCC doesn't know what other ways Google used to examine it, because Engineer Doe wouldn't talk to them about it. You know, all they got was this one instance, but beyond that, declined to testify, took the fifth. And the problem for Google is that, having initially said, no, we didn't collect any data at all. Oh, no, wait, we did collect some, but it was a complete accident. They're now moving from the situation where either they were complicit, you know, at the higher level, because Eric Schmidt and Larry Page were all people saying, well, accident, blah, blah, blah. Either they knew that this was going on, in which case they're complicit, or else they didn't know and they were simply saying it without having it properly investigated. Either way, it's a mess.
You mentioned that this technology was specifically developed to capture this information. So it sounds to me like, you know, this wasn't done on Engineer Doe's 20% free time.
It was done on his 20% time. That was when he developed it. Yes.
Oh, so this is something that's external. This wasn't effectively, you know, from a top-down bod saying what we would like.
It wasn't mandated, but they did say, I wonder if there's any possibilities in doing this. And he sort of, you know, pulled that together in the 20%. But putting it into a working Google product, that requires people to sign it off. And, you know, he did get a senior manager, in effect, to sign it off, because the senior manager didn't do enough oversight. He didn't, you know, Engineer Doe did suggest that there should be, a lawyer look at it, but that didn't happen. So, you know, there's mistakes all down the line, but equally, there's not enough people saying, possibly we shouldn't be collecting this. Perhaps we shouldn't do this at all. And, you know, but there seems to have been an inbuilt assumption that because they're Google, they can't have done anything wrong.
Well, why shouldn't they have collected it, Josh? I mean, if this is something that within the culture at Google seems perfectly reasonable, acceptable, it is a technology. It is neutral, is it not? Why not just collect this stuff, eh?
And it's,
we're not going to do evil with it.
Sure, it's important to point out that the FCC also has decided that this actually wasn't unlawful under US wiretap laws, but it did push the boundaries right to the edge of what most people, even the most internet-savvy people, would find acceptable. Would you really want Google to be who you are texting online, who you are emailing, which websites you're visiting? That's the kind of stuff that the government wants to start monitoring, you know, next year. But should Google be doing that? A private company? I'm not sure. This was approved by senior managers. Clearly, there was a huge failure of oversight. The FCC described it as minimal. And for such a hugely sensitive project, Street View, anyway, taking apart this collection of wireless data, Street View is controversial in many aspects anyway. The lack of oversight for the project is stunning, really.
Given that Street View has been controversial, and not just in the States where it's been less controversial, but say, for example, somewhere like Germany, this data was collected there as well, I'm assuming. So, you know, it may have gone to the bleeding edge of appropriateness within the regulation environment and the legislation environment in the US, but this is a global service, isn't it? So what implications does this then have for Google globally, Josh?
You're right to say that I think in many of the jurisdictions and countries outside the US, it probably overstepped the mark by a giant quantum leap. It will be interesting to see now whether any other regulators in Germany, as you say, or even in the UK, decide to relook at this project, given that the most thorough examination yet has come to light. And really, I do think it's interesting to contrast the FCC investigation with the UK's Information Commissioner's Office investigation. The Information Commissioner, remember, said he didn't want to make an enemy of Google and limited its own inquiry into the affair with a cursory visit to its Mountain View headquarters, and then absolved it of any wrongdoing pretty much whatsoever. It doesn't make them look good either.
We have actually asked the ICO whether it will re-examine Google on this because of the information that's come out from the FCC report. So we're waiting for a response from them.
And of course, that will be out as the coverage continues at guardian.co.uk/technology. Charles, what does this say about Google in terms of its size, its internal politics, and ultimately the validity of its motto?
I think that it indicates how you can't stay small forever. And while it was still a small company operating out of a garage, sure, you know, everyone knew what everyone else was doing. Very easy to keep a credo and an ethos going. But once you get past a certain size, once you need oversight, it, you know, things fall down between the cracks. And it's no good just to think that what you do is good. You have to actually ask yourself, you have to have means of oversight. Because when you're able to do this sort of enormous data collection, the data has power in its own right. And the fact that this engineer did this analysis, he did the analysis to see, well, what are people's favorite websites? That's the sort of point where you'd think that he might say, yeah, is this right? Are we absolutely sure that we're doing? I mean, I guess that probably he did think that it was fine to do this, but equally that's quite indicative in its own right. And the fact that Google still employs him, I spoke to Big Brother Watch earlier on Monday, and they said, you know, that's quite indicative that this guy is still working at Google, tells you a lot about how Google thinks about itself.
But why would this guy specifically be the fall guy for this? All he did was open up Pandora's box.
I think that's totally right. I mean, he flagged up in his own report as early as 2006 that this technology did need to be looked over by internal Google privacy lawyers. That never happened, and that could have prevented this whole mess from happening, and that's a failure that was above several pay grades above his head. So I don't think the book necessarily stopped with him. More questions need to be asked about these senior managers who had sight of the project, knew what it could do, and still gave it the green light.
Josh, final question. Do you think that this is going to have any real effect, sort of on-the-ground effect? I'm still going to end up probably using the search engine because it's my default. You know, is this going to have any on the ground effect?
It's hard to see that happening, isn't it? I mean, I'll be interested to see if the Daily Mail take this up, because they've had a recent campaign against Google for its link into online porn, which it's launched a campaign against. Whether it will throw this into its arsenal, I think could affect how you know, your everyday internet user sees Google and decides whether or not to use its service. But as you hinted there, I mean, its services and products are so ubiquitous now, it'd be hard to it would take real effort to switch all your services to another provider, which I think is a huge problem when it comes down to the small number of private companies that control such huge numbers of billions of users online.
Well, we'll be speaking with one of Google's competitors, DuckDuckGo, in the next couple of weeks, and so can find out a little bit more about the alternatives. Thanks very much for joining us, Josh.
Thank you.
This week, Samsung appeared to take the crown in the mobile phone space, and analysts estimate that it shipped more than 90 million phones, more than Nokia, which has held the lead since 1998. But Samsung itself hasn't said how many it shipped. The numbers come from analyst estimates based on percentage growth figures given to them by the company. And this isn't the only news in the telecom sector. We're joined down the line by Horace Didier, a mobile communications analyst at ASIMCO. Thank you very much for joining us, Horace.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Do you think that Samsung has overtaken Nokia for total mobile phones shipped in this quarter?
I think that's a pretty near certainty. We have good data from Samsung with respect to their financials, and they do hint quite a bit about what they shipped, although they don't give us exact figures. But it does seem like they overtook Nokia, and that would be the first time in 14 years that Nokia hasn't been number one.
So what do you think, Horace, it's Charles Arthur, what do you think this indicates about what is happening then in the broader handset market? For Samsung to have come out of pretty much nowhere in the past, what, 6-7 years or so? I mean, its growth has been really very rapid to this point where it's now gone past Nokia, which had been at the top for so long and which is still the number two in the world. What does this tell us about how the handset market is changing?
I frame these sort of massive changes in industries as disruptions. What I would say about Samsung is that Samsung, being flexible about its platform choices, it had always been agnostic and had implemented all manner of operating systems from Windows Mobile to Palm OS to variants of Linux. and now most recently, obviously, with Android. But when it did Android, it's also accelerated its adoption because it was very economical for them to do so. And they moved about 40 to 45% of their portfolio mix, meaning the number of units shipped, to being smartphones, whereas Nokia peaked at around 24% and has been sliding ever since. Which is about starting about a year ago, their percent of mix of smartphones has been in decline, while that market has been growing and the non-smart market has been shrinking. So, in effect, Samsung didn't have to grow all overall units very much to overtake Nokia. Just Nokia imploded in its strategy.
What do you think about the disagreements between the analysts about precisely how many phones Samsung has put out there? So, for example, iSupply is estimating somewhere around 32 million. Strategy Analytics is saying about 44.5 million. Apple itself has said for the iPhone 35 million. It seems like there's a fair bit of bragging rights here. But why is there this disagreement between the different research companies?
Well, because Samsung hasn't given us figures for a long time, so we've been multiplying assumptions ever since. And that means that we were making a guess and then multiplying that guess by another guess. And so if you make a wrong guess early on, it tends to be amplified further down. Now, they did actually give a figure. I believe the CEO of Samsung gave a figure of the number of units they sell on a daily basis, smartphones on a daily basis. And if you multiply that out, it comes out to something like 43 million.
Why doesn't Samsung want this information out there? What possible benefit is there?
I believe, this is my hypothesis, the companies that have stopped reporting this have been in litigation, namely Samsung and HTC. HTC did it also stopped the reporting data about 2 quarters ago, and Samsung stopped about a year ago. Both of these companies have been sued by both Microsoft and by Apple, and potentially many others. I don't know. We don't know the whole story. The reason this becomes relevant is because if they lose the case, or if somehow the data influences the decision of the case, they will be liable for paying royalties on the numbers of units shipped. Now, if they would declare that data, that becomes automatically sort of the baseline by which someone would declare the judgment or the penalty. If they are able to fudge a little bit on those numbers, in case they lose, they might be able to say, well, this is the actual number and it isn't what we reported or it isn't what we would have reported. So that could be a reason why they're doing this. But I can't be sure. That's just my own theory. I see the pattern of information cutting off right when the litigation became a hot issue.
And also last week we had Apple's financial results, which showed that the iPhone is a tremendous revenue generator for it. I think the iPhone now generates more revenue than Microsoft does in its whole business, and that Apple has become a mobile company, that all its money really seems to be coming from mobile rather than items such as, you know, well, it used to be Apple Computer once upon a time, and yet it's shifted away from that. What's your view on that?
Well, I counted that if you look at either if you include Apple's portables, meaning their laptops, you get a unit number that is essentially 98% of all their units shipped are essentially mobile units. If you take the Mac portable out, it becomes 92%. In either case, you're looking at a company that by volume is over 90% of its volume is mobile devices. Obviously, in terms of profitability, the 50% margin or more they have on the iPhone and the 33% margin they probably have on the iPad are driving the bottom line in terms of profitability, maybe even higher than 90% being mobile. What that implies to me is that Apple now is really the most visible. When people talk about mobility being almost in a bubble, but it's actually, if you add up the numbers, you see that Apple captures probably the bulk of the profits available in all of mobile computing. In contrast, to a Microsoft or a Google where it's hard to find in their financials any evidence of mobile profitability or even mobile sales. Certainly they have some, but they don't advertise it. They don't declare it. They don't talk about it. And it's I think, a phenomenal story that Apple went from being a PC company, a computer company, to becoming the most visible and profitable mobile player, whereas its contemporaries like Microsoft haven't made the switch yet.
Horace, is that sustainable? We've seen other mobile companies, notably Nokia and to an extent RIM, suffering because of interlopers, whether it's Samsung or Apple. So is this a sustainable strategy? Should they not be continuing to diversify so that they have a bit of protection?
I would think they you're right about that. It is a very, very rapidly changing marketplace, and the right thing to do is to constantly innovate. You can't try to protect your position. I think a litigation strategy is not a valid strategy. The courts take much longer to decide things than markets do. But I do believe it's in Apple's DNA to constantly continue to innovate. And we've seen that with the iPad, which arguably is a disruptive product to Apple's own Mac business. We've seen them move to the iPhone in the first place, which was disruptive to the MP3 player. Let's not forget that at one time the iPod was the bulk of Apple's valuation. And when the iPod first suffered a decline in year-on-year sales, the stock went down like 40%. And yet what Apple had been planning all along was to replace the iPod with the iPhone, which they did. So yes, I believe that we'll see a slowdown in the iPhone eventually. And then we'll hope, one would hope, that they have something else coming after that in terms of driving the next generation of computing. I do not believe, for example, that what we have today in the form of the iPhone or an Android device is the culmination of all possible ways of having mobile computing. There are plenty of innovations in laboratories around the world which can be commercialized, everything from new user interfaces to new form factors, wearable devices, and so on, which could change the way we interact with computers, from voice to gestures and all that. Excellent. And all that Apple did was took one new interface, which was finger touch, and that created this massive, massive growth for them and others as well.
Horace, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you very much. And for more on this, definitely keep your eye on guardian.co.uk/technology. That's it for this week's podcast. Links to all the stories are available at guardian.co.uk/techweekly, where you can also find out how to get in touch with us. We're back next Tuesday. This week's producer was Jason Phipps. Thanks for listening.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.